Every year for the past 25 years, CareerCast.com has ranked the best and worst jobs. This hour, we hear from people who work at some of these jobs. It's River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. The Best and Worst Jobs Report used criteria like physical demands, work environment, income, stress, and hiring outlook. Today, we'll listen back to my conversations with people who work at some of the best jobs, according to the survey, an audiologist in Des Moines, a biomedical engineer in Iowa City, and a few people who supposedly have the worst jobs, according to the ranking, a newspaper reporter, and an oil rig worker on the north coast of Alaska. The best and worst jobs after this news. I'm Ben Kiefer with River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. Today you're listening to an encore edition of the program. For the past 25 years, CareerCast.com, a career website, has put out its annual jobs report, and each year it has ranked 200 jobs from best to worst based on these five criteria: physical demands, work environment, income, stress, and hiring outlook. So this hour, we're talking about the year's best and worst jobs according to this ranking and talking with some people, some Iowans who have these jobs. Joining me now, a man who holds a job that is ranked the second best job, Professor Tom Cassavant. He is a biomedical engineer. He also has the title of the Roy J. Carver Jr. Chair in Bioinformatics and Computational Biology at the University of Iowa. He is also director of the University of Iowa Center for Bioinformatics and Computational Biology. Tom Cassavant, welcome to our program.
Thanks.
So tell us, biomedical engineer can mean, I think, a lot of things. Give us an idea of what it can mean.
Sure. Well, there's a broad spectrum, and it's an increasing spectrum. The endpoints keep moving. The field started with things that people would probably recognize easily: artificial joints, hip joints, knee joints, and what we call musculoskeletal biomechanics. And so that kind of engineering, you know, kind of sprung out of mechanical engineering and other disciplines like that in the natural sciences, physics, and so on. And then, kind of has evolved over the years, involves, you know, cardiovascular biomechanics and fluids, artificial valves, that kind of thing, prostheses. And then biomaterials, we're kind of getting into, you know, a much more contemporary topic, though, with tissue engineering and grafting and implants and things like that. Bioimaging, most people are very familiar with lots of different technologies for bioimaging, MRI, X-ray, PET, CT. And then we also, along the line there, a lot of people who are doctors, practicing physicians, are trained in biomedical engineering. So pre-med is a common goal of biomedical engineering students at the University of Iowa. And then we get into kind of the 21st century part of this, or late 20th century to early 21st century, with molecular and cellular engineering, looking at simulating and analyzing the functioning and the structure of cells at the molecular level, and then finally getting into genetics and basically about the lowest level that you can think of in terms of granularity, of looking at the interactions between genes and proteins and different chemicals at that molecular level. And so computation has become a really big part of that field, and my claim as a biomedical engineer kind of came in through a bit of a side door. My training was in mathematics, computer science, and electrical engineering. And so, in fact, when I was studying as an undergrad, biomedical engineering hardly existed at all as a discipline. It kind of grew out of that collection of those things that recognized.
But this has been in the 70s about or something
probably
like that?
Probably 70s and 80s. Mm-hmm. That, in fact, the biomedical engineering program at the University of Iowa is one of the oldest biomedical engineering programs in existence. And it started out, it kind of progressed through that series of fields that I mentioned. And so in the 1990s, I started collaborating with some people at the University of Iowa that were doing human genetics.
So tell us, what is the most cutting-edge thing, the thing that you're working on or working toward, that has the wow factor.
Right. So there are two aspects to it, and that's why the center that I direct is called Bioinformatics and Computational Biology. Bioinformatics is the field that's driven by just this tsunami of data that's coming at us from all of these different platforms that can generate genetic information, protein information. So far, most of those technologies have been used in research almost exclusively, but they're coming into the clinical setting. And the interpretation of that kind of data in a clinical setting in terms of trying to do personalized medicine and healthcare that's much more tailored to not just what the symptoms are observed in your clinical setting, but looking at the molecular level and seeing, you know, the genes that are being transcribed and what these proteins are and how they're, you know, how a defective gene might lead you to understanding a compound or a treatment or a therapy that's much more focused. And to me, that's what an engineer does. An engineer, first of all, understands what the problem is completely and then designs a solution to that problem. And I think the way that pharmacology and, you know, the pharmaceutical engineering or pharmaceutical industry has operated for many years was very much a big shelf full of compounds that maybe some of them already had FDA approval, so they had that going for them, that they were something that could be used in a medical setting and didn't have to go through all these stages of validation and approval and so on, that they would simply start trying these things on laboratory animals to see if they would have an effect that was, you know, mm-hmm. that was desired. It was not a let's understand exactly what's happening and design a solution kind of thing. So I was actually kind of horrified to find out how pharmaceutical companies and the pharmaceutical industry basically develop compounds. They would kind of guess thousands of times to come up with something that might work.
But now with the increasing computer power, we've moved away from that to understanding the problem and designing solutions, is what you're saying.
We are definitely moving, you know, towards a much more deliberate design of therapies and treatments for disease.
So I'm not sure it's entirely clear to me, but the bioinformatics and computational biology, those are the thrusts of your center. Tell me the difference between those and what they mean a little bit more.
Right. So the bioinformatics part I already talked about a fair amount. It has to do with dealing with this deluge of data that we're mm-hmm. getting from all these instruments. So the computational biology part can be working with a large amount of data, but more often with a small amount of data, but doing a very detailed modeling and prediction. So, for example, trying to predict the structure of a folded protein. The sequence itself may only be a few hundred or a few thousand amino acids long, but trying to predict the conformation of that and the three-dimensional structure of that protein is well-known, very difficult problem in computational biology. And it's one where you can literally use up almost all the compute time on all the computers you can find very easily. And one of my colleagues here, Mike Schneiders in biomedical engineering, works on that protein folding problem and also looking at the structure of DNA and RNA and other molecules as well. And he is one of the biggest consumers of computing resources on campus.
So tell me, in that research, apply it to daily lives. How will that help us now or people in the future understanding the way those folds work?
Well, it's really in one way, it's a very simple example. If you take a drug or a vitamin or some kind, you know, you ingest something and you want it to have an effect, one of the things eventually that's going to have to happen is that those molecules are going to have to bind to other molecules. So it's kind of like, you know, knowing how a particular wrench will fit a particular nut or something. You have to know what those shapes are so that they can actually interlock. There's other things as well. There's, you know, electromagnetic forces as well. So you can have the right shape, but if they're both negatively charged, they're going to repel each other and not come together. So predicting those things from the raw data that we have, it might be a fairly small amount of data, but it can be literally years of computation time on very fast computers.
Right? If you would say, and speaking to young people, parents and young people listening to this program right now, perhaps, fill in the blank. If I wanted to be, as a young person, a biomedical engineer, I'd better be, and fill in the blank with traits or abilities.
Yeah. I mean, you'd better be the kid who doesn't dread doing their math homework and who enjoys science, but then also has the tenacity to kind of stick with problems that are hard to solve and don't solve themselves quickly.
Do you find yourself pondering, puzzling over things in your field, in your off hours while you're having dinner, while you're swimming? I know you're a big swimmer.
Absolutely. So it's amazing how many times, you know, I'll get some inspiration from something for solving a problem in a very different context. So I think it's a lot of fun when I think there's an impression people have of engineers that they're, you know, the guys with the buttoned up collar and the pocket protector, and they have no imagination or creativity. And it's exactly the opposite. To be a really good engineer is a very creative process.
So tell me, why is it creative? What's an example of creativity in biomedical engineering?
Well, so simply the idea of taking a process that maybe was initially conceived for one thing and then using it in a totally different way. In about 2000, I was actually visiting a lab in France where they were interested in studying genes that were responsible for programmed cell death. Now, maybe that sounds really horrible, but programmed cell death is really important. When you're outside in the summer and gamma rays hit your cells and the DNA gets rearranged and scrambled, you don't get cancer 99.9% of the time because there's a gene, P53, which recognizes that something has gone wrong in a cell and it kills the cell. So there's this, it's called apoptosis, that kills these cells off. Well, I was working with a fellow in Grenoble in 2000, and he was interested in a particular type of gene that he knew did this, but he thought that there were probably other genes like that. And in the early 21st century, in 2000, we weren't quite finished sequencing the human genome, and there were some tools that had been developed to try to find similar proteins to each other. So this tool that was developed for finding similar proteins was something that at the time I was kind of playing around with. It was using a mathematical technique called hidden Markov modeling. And I thought, you know, what if I just took all of this genomic sequence, not protein sequence, only about 3% of which actually codes for proteins, and just translated it all as if it was proteins, and then used this hidden Markov modeling technique to see if I could find things that were similar to the proteins that this guy was collaborating with. And sure enough, we immediately found the mother load of all of those genes. And we've done that in two or three other cases. I was working with Paul McCray here at the University of Iowa in innate immunity, and we found this family of beta defensin genes by a similar technique.
That's fascinating. I wonder if you have an overview of the demand for biomedical engineers and the question of whether we're meeting that demand. Are young people going into these areas?
You know, it's important to distinguish between the field of biomedical engineering and the training of biomedical engineers. I think that, my own training is not in biomedical engineering, but I'm very much work as a biomedical engineer. And I think it's important to know that you can train in different disciplines in engineering, and then throughout your career, you will be able to apply what you have learned. That I always tell my students is kind of like a tool belt. And there are really, really sharp tools in that tool belt if you get an engineering education. And so then things that you find interesting throughout the rest of your life, you can apply those tools to. So I think that the demand for biomedical engineers is huge. I think that our economy is not, you know, hasn't been based on, you know, mass production of things for a long time. And I think that this kind of, you know, drive from creativity, from, you know, new products and inventions has been the critical part of our economy for a long time. And I think it will be. I definitely worry when I, see that, you know, the demand for engineering graduates, you know, outstrips the supply all the time. Yet at the same time, that maybe is one of the reasons that biomedical engineer was so high on this list, is because the career outlook is not like it is for, I'll pick on another field, but some field where there's a huge supply of folks to do it, but not a huge demand, or not the corresponding demand.
You know, in talking about inspirations to get into careers, and as young people, we're inspired by, I don't know, comics, books, movies, all kinds of things. Do you see things out there in popular culture that inspire people to become engineers and biomedical engineers?
Yeah, I think that happens in a lot of fields. You know, people, you know, want to be policemen or firemen or whatever. But as when I was growing up, I didn't remember seeing a lot of, you know, movies that highlighted engineers. And frankly, when I graduated from high school, the only reason I went into engineering was because my calculus teacher said that I should be an engineer, even though I didn't even know what it was, to be honest. honest. But the movies, I think, recently have done a better job of this, and I think Apollo 13 is a great example. In fact, it's in the, you know, my top five
movies. The one with Tom Hanks and they can't get back from the moon and
right.
all
and,
that.
And, mm-hmm. and the scene in there, I think that's a kind of especially, you know, typifies why you might like this field, if you like it, is the one where the CO2 filters on the command module are clogged and they're going to, you know, they're going to die from carbon monoxide poisoning. And so they have to come up with a solution for this. And so the guy comes into the room and he dumps out this basket of junk on top of the table, and he says, "We need to make this filter here, and it's, you know, we have this shape, and it needs to go in this other shaped hole, and you got to give them the detailed directions of how to assemble this thing." And these guys are just like, "You need to me." I look at them, and I see their eyes just light up, like, "Yeah, this is the kind of problem we live for."
Yeah. Right.
And I think it's what appeals to this is that, you know, you have to create something where it wasn't before, and I think that is the essence of creativity. But you're using these very technical capabilities and having to, in the end. And the difference between this and art is that in you can't do wrong art, but you can definitely build a bridge wrong, right?
Right.
And I think you can, you know, there's a lot of things in a lot of ways to solve the problem. But in the end, you know, there are some really important things that we're trying to address. And I teach my software engineering students this all the time, that, you know, this isn't just a matter of getting a good grade in this class. You really need to master this subject. And in fact, as far as I'm concerned, you either get an A in this class or you should fail. Because I don't want you out there designing, you know, the software for the plane that I'm going to take, you know, next time to New York if you don't really know what you're doing for sure.
Professor Tom Cassavant, biomedical engineer, the Roy J. Carver Jr. Chair in Bioinformatics and Computational Biology, also director of the University of Iowa's Center for Bioinformatics and Computational Biology. Tom, thank you for coming in today.
You're welcome.
Jobs, the best and the worst, our topic for this hour of the program. Well, it's all subjective, of course, but for the past 25 years, CareerCast.com, that's a career website, has put out its annual jobs report. And this hour, we thought it would be nice to talk with some of the people who have, according to this survey, some of the best and the worst jobs out there. Joining me now, Robert Pepper. Robert Pepper works on an oil rig. Hi, Robert.
Hello, how are you?
Where are you now? You're not on the rig, right?
No, I'm at home. I live in Kenai, Alaska.
Kenai, Alaska. You are, broadly speaking, an oil rig worker, but more specifically, safety technician on an oil rig. How do you feel about, I'm looking at the rankings, Robert, how do you feel about the fact that out of 200 jobs listed by CareerCast.com in this annual jobs report, oil rig worker is the bottom?
Well, you know, like you said, this is all subjective. You know, I can't speak for oil fields in Oklahoma or Texas where you know, the ranking might actually apply, but on the North Slope of Alaska, I really don't think it does. The oil field jobs that are in the North Slope are usually very well paying. They're not too stressful. I mean, they can be, but it's a very lucrative field to get into in this state.
Mm-hmm. So give me an idea geographically where you are, because you say you're off the north coast of Alaska. Are you in the Arctic Circle?
It's above the Arctic Circle where I work. Right now I'm home on R&R, but when I work, it's above the Arctic Circle on the north slope of Alaska by the Beaufort Sea. It's as far north as you can go on the continent, you know, as far as the closest city would be Barrow, Alaska, which is the northernmost city in North America.
So you work a certain number of days on the rig, and then you recover.
That's correct. It's called shift work, and a lot of people in the state of Alaska work this type of schedule, whether it's in the oil field or in mining or fishing. And what happens is the person, the breadwinner of the family will physically leave where they live and go work, and then come back after their work shift is done.
Mm-hmm. So you work at a stretch how long on the rig?
I work a 3-3 schedule. So I work 3 weeks on, where I'm physically removed from my home and am working on the North Slope, and then I return home, and I have 3 weeks off.
You said you're a safety technician on this oil rig.
What does that involve on a day-to-day basis?
On a day-to-day basis, what it is just observing people and their work habits, observing the equipment, observing the tools, making sure that the tools are in good working order, the environment is as safe as possible, and that the workers themselves are doing everything they can to ensure that they don't get hurt on the job. Somebody hits their hand with a hammer or gets something in their eye or not wearing the proper hearing protection because the rigs can get pretty loud. There's a lot of equipment on the rig that makes a lot of noise while it's working. And so, and this is a new position for me. I've done a lot of different jobs up there, but it's on a day-to-day basis. Since I've done a lot of the work, I can see somebody doing something that could possibly endanger themselves, and I'll intervene and say, hey, why don't we do it like this?
When you're on that, so close to the North Pole, what's the weather like? What are the seasons like?
Well, there's two seasons. There's really, really hot and cold. The summer, there is a summer up there, and it's really nice. It does get into the 70s and the 80s.
And it never goes dark during the day, right?
It never goes dark during the day, no. And on the other hand, in the winter, it doesn't get light, so it can get really cold.
How many months do you have without seeing the sun at all?
Probably about three.
Total?
And then you start to see a sliver of the sun as it, you know, crests the horizon, and then it just gets totally the opposite where the sun's out all the time, you know.
Wow. How cold can it get on that rig?
You can get wind chill temperatures of the coldest I've ever worked was 105 below.
105 below with wind chill.
105 below with the wind chill.
Well,
let's see. I was 40 below ambient my last hitch up there, so it can get really cold.
That's pretty much that. You spit and it hits the ground as ice.
That's pretty much that's true, Ben. That's true.
You've actually done that.
Yes, I have, and I've known people that have done that, and it turns ice to ice before it hits the ground.
What appeals to you most about this job, even though, according to the survey, it's one of the worst jobs?
Well, once again, I'm not a rig hand on a rig. I'm a safety technician, so, you know, I think maybe that is a generalization, maybe taken from many different snapshots all over the United States and maybe around the world, because there are oil fields in existence that we hear are run kind of shoddy, or, you know, they don't really care about the people. You know, that's not the case in Alaska. Alaska, it's so far removed, and it's so geographically detached. They had to put enough infrastructure up there to keep people comfortable. So the camps you stay in up there are pretty nice. The food is great. There's gyms up there. There's movie theaters up there. So where I work, as far as the oil field goes, it's really the creme de la creme of oil fields, to my understanding.
Well, Robert Pepper, nice to talk to you, and glad to hear you are passionate about your job and you love it, and stay safe and keep on enjoying it.
Okay, well, thank you very much, and it was a pleasure talking to you.
Robert Pepper works as a safety technician on an oil rig off the north coast of Alaska. Coming up after a short break, we'll talk with an audiologist and a newspaper reporter as we continue exploring the best and the worst jobs according to a CareerCast.com survey. This is River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer with River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. Today you're listening to an encore edition of the program. For the past 25 years, CareerCast.com, a career website, has put out its annual jobs report, and each year it takes 200 jobs and ranks them from best to worst. And it bases these rankings on five criteria: stress, the hiring outlook, income, work environment, physical demands. So this hour, we're taking a look at this year's best and worst jobs according to this ranking and talking with a few of the people who have some of these jobs on the best side and on the worst side as well. Well, the top of the list, the best jobs of 2013, according to this survey, at number one, actuary.
someone who interprets statistics, perhaps for an insurance company. Number two, a biomedical engineer, finding solutions in biology and medicine. We heard from Tom Cassavant in the first part of our program. At number three, software engineer, no surprise there. At number four, on the best jobs list, audiologist. That's someone who diagnoses and treats hearing problems. Joining us now, Diana Hansen, who is a pediatric audiologist at Unity Point Health in Des Moines. Welcome to our program, Diana.
Thank you.
Are you surprised to hear this ranking, that out of 200 jobs, you are at the top of the best jobs list?
Well, I would think we would be number one, but
okay.
I'm kind of biased.
So describe your work and what makes it so satisfying.
Well, as a pediatric audiologist, I get the opportunity to work with very young patients from the day they're born until age 21. And I get to help families deal with hearing loss when that occurs in their kids. And it's very emotional. You get to know the families. So it's kind of like a family of your own. As each patient returns and comes back, you join their family in terms of a relationship with them and help them.
Mm-hmm. With kids, newborns, what type of hearing problems do you encounter when, I assume, it's rare that you have hearing problems at birth or not?
Actually, it's the most prevalent disorder that is identified in children.
Mm.
It can be usually around 3 babies per 1,000 births have permanent hearing loss. So we have, the state of Iowa has mandated newborn hearing screening, which every baby receives a hearing screening prior to discharge from the hospital. So before 2 weeks of age, if a baby doesn't pass that screening, they are usually identified with a permanent hearing loss if that is the case with that child.
Mm-hmm. And so what is going on if you're born with a hearing loss? What has gone wrong there?
Well, it can be a number of factors. Genetics play a part. There can be syndromes that are a cause of hearing loss, sometimes just family history of hearing loss, chromosomal abnormalities. Sometimes viruses can attack the ears and cause a hearing issue. If a mom doesn't know she's pregnant and drinks alcohol in the first 3 months of pregnancy, that can also impact a child's hearing.
Mm-hmm. You talked a moment ago about how rewarding it is to work with families and get to know them, in many cases, over years. Talk about the impact that hearing loss can have on a person's life, because it can cripple us in certain ways socially, can't it?
Oh, definitely. Birth to 3 years of life is the critical time for developing speech and language. And if a child cannot hear what other people are saying, they certainly are impacted in that way. So if we are late to identify hearing loss, oftentimes those children don't have speech and language skills that are needed to communicate with their family or peers. So that's the biggest hurdle. Even with kids that are identified and are appropriately fit with hearing aids or cochlear implants, that oftentimes is the biggest challenge, to make sure they are able to communicate with their family. And there's a lot of choices in that, too. Mm-hmm. It's not just sign language or teaching someone how to speak. There can be other choices that families need to make as well.
Now, you mentioned cochlear implants. Talk a little bit, and I don't know, Diana Hansen, about how long you've been in this work.
22 years.
There. You have a little bit of a long view then.
Mm-hmm.
So talk about the last 2 decades of advances in correcting some hearing problems.
Well, hearing aids themselves have come a long way. It used to be just it would make sounds louder, the hearing aid would. Now there are multi-channel, multi-frequency hearing aids that are digital, and the sound itself is much more accurate in terms of what the speech signal actually is. But if children have too severe of a hearing loss and or adults and not able to benefit from hearing aids, cochlear implants also are multi-channel. And just in the office today, I had a cochlear implant kiddo who I was able to speak to him at a normal level in my testing, and he could easily understand everything I was saying. And he just has one in one ear, and the opposite ear, he wears a hearing aid, and he got nothing correct in that ear. So It's just a testament how far it has come. And most of those kids by kindergarten are at age level as far as speech and language with their peers.
That's wonderful. But I suppose with kindergartners, grade schoolers, another big factor is they don't want people to know that they have these AIDS, right?
Actually, kids are most children are pretty if the family goes about it in a positive way, they're proud of their hearing aids and it's part of them. And certainly the cosmetics have improved of devices, but certainly I feel like if you go about it in a positive way and other peers are – they understand that, you know, my friend needs this to hear, it's not as much of an issue as people think it might be. Adults have more of an issue with that.
Oh, how so?
Well, they're kind of – can be a little vain and, you know, it's hard to accept maybe as you're getting older that you might need a hearing aid. And it's, A, hard to accept how it feels in your ear possibly. And, you know, you're always maybe thinking about whether what other people are thinking or perceiving of you. So kids generally, especially at a younger age, you know, that's not much of an issue for them.
You talked about technology that can help hearing impairments, but we have a lot of technology out there that damages hearing.
Right.
In 2013, what are the what's on your hit list as far as technology that really damages kids or other
people? Own children have iPods and, you know, they have headphones, and that is the biggest one that I think 20, 30 years from now we'll start to see noise-induced hearing loss because of people listening to their music too loud with those devices. So,
how do you know what is too loud?
Well, if you can hear the music or the sound leaking out of the headphones when you're sitting right next to a person, that's too loud.
And earbuds the same, I would imagine.
Correct.
Yeah, that's even more extreme, isn't it?
Yes.
Mm-hmm. You work a lot with newborns, of course, as a pediatric audiologist. How in the heck do you test a newborn? You can't exactly say, raise your hand, right hand, left hand.
That's right. There are two tests that we use. Otoacoustic emissions presents sound at different pitches to a baby's ear. The sound goes down the ear canal. If the ear hears it, and I'm talking about the inner ear, there's little hair cells there that make a noise, and that noise comes back out and is measured by the same probe that went into the ear to produce the sound. If that baby passes, that means the ear heard the sound. And, you know, that baby has all in all good hearing. The second test that we use if the baby doesn't pass that is called auditory brainstem response. It's a screening, but it uses the brain's EEG recording. You can use electrodes to measure that and combine that with a sound stimulus, which helps to determine if a child can hear that way.
The reward of this job, and you do have one of the best jobs, according to this survey. You say it should be number one. It's not quite number one, but it's number four. That's pretty good out of 200.
That's awesome.
Can you recall a case where you just felt all the satisfaction and reward of restoring someone's hearing and knew what it meant to an individual, perhaps to a family?
I can think of several cases where at maybe 2 or 3 weeks of age, we had diagnosed the hearing loss and started working with the family. And by the time there, I have several kids now. I've worked at Unity Point for 11 years, and there's several families that their kids are now coming back as, you know, young teenagers, and they're doing great in school. You know, they're excelling. There's a kiddo I started working with at age 5 who is going to Iowa State next year, has a 32 ACT, many scholarships. I mean, hearing loss doesn't have to hold these kids back. So that just whole that reward is in the ending result with most of these kids. When you put hearing aids on a baby that really wasn't reacting to sound, and you start talking to them, and either they cry because they're scared, or they turn and look at their parents. Especially if they're a little bit older, like 4 or 5 months of age, that, yes, parents have cried, they videotape, you know, it's interesting to see the reaction, and it's rewarding to see that, yes, before the hearing aids, they weren't hearing, and now they truly can hear their family.
Helping to hear mom and dad's voice for the very first time. I can't think of anything more rewarding than that.
Yes.
Diana Hansen, thank you for sharing a bit of your work with us, pediatric audiologist at Unity Point Health in Des Moines. We appreciate this conversation.
No problem.
We've been talking about jobs this hour. We've been hearing from people who, according to an annual report by CareerCast.com, have some of the best and the worst jobs. So how do they decide this? They've been doing it for 25 years. It's based on five criteria, according to them: physical demands, work environment, income, stress, and hiring outlook. So finally today, we end with a job. I guess this is a downer, but we'll find out. We end with a job identified by this year's CareerCast.com report as the worst out of 200 jobs they identified. It's a newspaper reporter. That's a surprise to me. Let's see if it's a surprise to my final guest today. Jesse Bonner is an education reporter with the Ames Tribune. Hi, Jesse.
Hi there. Thanks for having me.
A surprise to you to hear that?
You know, journalists have been making these types of lists for a while. I think being a skeptic, you know, as a journalist, I can't help but think, you know, we make these lists because they know we'll write about them.
Right. We create a peg so we have something to do.
Exactly.
Well, you have just a little background on you. You have been a newspaper reporter for 9 years, I understand, and you've worked at the Ames Tribune. How long?
I have been there since April, so mm-hmm. I'm just starting out at that job. But I've actually, over my career, I've worked for three different newspapers and as well as Newswire services.
Mm-hmm. CareerCast.com cited, quote, ever-shrinking newsrooms, dwindling budgets, and competition from internet businesses among the factors that make newspaper journalism jobs the nation's worst. Having worked at three newspapers, to what extent do you or have you in your nearly decade-long career felt these difficult factors with the digital age?
Well, of course, you know, reporters are feeling that, you know, more concentrated now, of course. At the beginning of my career, you know, I had dozens of opportunities to choose from. And, of course, that has changed with the shrinking of the job market. I will say about, you know, all the things that this study has pointed out, they're all true, you know, but as someone who really enjoys their job and really loves the work, I am still very satisfied by the work I do. And I think it's just it depends on who you are and what you're looking at. A lot of these things that they pointed out, you know, salary, work hours and stress, you know, I think these are things that come with any job, and you just have to ask yourself what's important. Is having a long-term salary and having all these benefits, all of which I've had over my career, you know, when I was working for the Associated Press, you know, I had a very good salary, very great benefit package, and even now I'm very happy with my benefits. The thing is, it's just really you have to ask yourself what's important. Do you want a career that's constantly challenging you and constantly interesting you? And I'm very satisfied with what I'm doing.
Mm-hmm. They pointed to low pay there, but also the jobs report said high stress, tight deadlines, a requirement to work in all conditions to get the story. But it seems to me, as someone who also works in journalism, that's why we get into it, right? It's exciting.
Yeah.
It's exciting to have a deadline, to dig out the facts of a story, to have that little adrenaline rush, isn't it? Being on deadline.
Well, yeah, of course, and you start to thrive on that. But I was thinking a little bit about this, like all the experience that I've had as a journalist. You know, I've been, you know, in a single engine Cessna flying into the Idaho wilderness. I've seen the president give a State of the Union address when I was doing a journalism internship in Washington, D.C. You know, I've met people that I would have never met had I not been a journalist, and I've told their stories, and I've had just so much fun and so much satisfaction doing that.
Mm-hmm. Tell me about a story you've recently covered. You named several, but what one that you've covered recently or within the last few years where you said to yourself at the end of the day, wow, I have got one of the best jobs.
Well, you know, my husband's a journalist, too, and we laugh about this because it's like we still feel this way. You know, it's like as much as you see these studies that come out and, you know, and we're looking at the same numbers that everyone else is, but there's still a lot of days where we come home and we say we can't believe that we get paid anything to do this. you know, interesting story here in Ames, you know, I just met a kid over here at Iowa State who, you know, he had been obsessed with footwear his whole life, you know, and now he is graduating and he's going off to do an internship with Adidas in Germany. And he had a really interesting story. That's something I've done here. You know, just the story that I mentioned, flying on the plane into the Idaho wilderness, that was amazing. You know, there was this backcountry mail pilot who was delivering mail to these people who lived, you know, outside the bounds of civilization. And, you know, how could you not think that's the coolest thing ever, you know, to spend some time with that guy who has just lived so much, you know, and just hear about his experiences. It was just, it's been amazing.
I imagine you know, parties or gatherings, family gatherings, you talk about these stories as everybody shares their work experiences. And I imagine it's not that uncommon for you to hear, Jesse, you have got a really cool job, Jesse.
Oh, yeah, definitely. You know, I'm pretty sure my family, people, it's hard for them to grasp, I think, what journalists actually do. And so I always joke about that. You know, even when I was working for the AP, it was like, I'm pretty sure my family has no idea what I'm doing. but... You know, we grow up, we go to college, and you're told to be smart, you know, get jobs with really, you know, your parents tell you this, get a good benefits package, 401ks are important and things like that. But I like to think about my younger self, you know, what would the 8-year-old version of me, you know, wanted me to do? And, you know, I drove here today in a car that's filled with maps because I'm learning the town still. And I think the younger version of myself would think that's pretty cool. Mm-hmm. You know?
Yeah. So you're part explorer.
Right. Exactly. Mm-hmm. Exactly. If you're journalism is just a great field for someone who is curious and loves to explore the world around them. And it's just, yeah, there are those moments where you can't believe you get paid to do something like this.
You said a moment ago that perhaps even your family still has questions. What do you do? So give us an idea of what a day at work can be like for you.
Well, you mentioned, you know, with the expansion of the internet, you know, social media, things like that, a lot of your day is increasingly online. I find I rely a lot on, you know, the first thing when I get in, I am online. For the good first part of that shift, like looking to see what is going on out there, what are people talking about in the community. You know, you're making calls to if there's a meeting, you know, like I'm covering education. So if there's a school board meeting, you know, you're making calls to the people who are going to be there, finding out like what's going to happen there. And so you're prepared. So you have an idea of what's going on. And then, you know, for instance, today I did an interview yesterday with an Iowa State graduate, another graduate. And so I will be in the office later today finishing up her story. And a lot of journalists are also taking photos now. So I will also be filing photos for that story. Mm-hmm. And
a nice sense of teamwork, it sounds like.
Oh, yeah, definitely. Definitely. Mm-hmm.
When you think about the most rewarding aspects of the job, how much do you pay attention to reaction you get from community members who read the Tribune online or on paper?
You know, it's you love to, I love personally to get feedback from people. I love to know what they're thinking. A great example is I had wrote a story about these Iowa State is doing these new housing agreements where they're securing housing off campus to provide more housing because they have this backlog of requests from students wanting to get university housing. Well, I had wrote the story and I received a call from a mother who was having a problem where her daughters were actually being moved from the building that Iowa State was leasing, you know, and she had called and she was like, why didn't your story talk about that? Mm-hmm. You know, that kids were going to be moved out of the building to make way for Iowa State to lease it. And it ended up just being a really interesting story. And looking into it, you find, well, there's actually 200 students who are being relocated as part of this. I think people, I hope they understand. It's like journalists are there, are your eyes and ears, and we want to hear from you. We want to hear what you're thinking. It doesn't always lead to a story like that, but that's why we're here. We play a very vital role in the community.
Well, finally, Jesse Bonner, I wanted to ask you what you see. And I know, Jesse, that education is your beat there in Ames, not necessarily crystal ball gazing. But what do you see when you imagine the future of writing for newspapers? Because, well, within a decade or two, news on paper as such will be probably an anachronism, an archaic term. There will no longer be papers with news on them. What do you see for your work?
Well, I mean, I'm excited about the changes. I mean, there is some amazing storytelling that is going on that is being done in a new way. I mean, you're seeing video storytelling that is still very strong journalism, but it's just being done in a new platform. And I'm really excited about being part of that. I mean, I'm really excited about who doesn't want to work in a field where they're learning new skills. And I have learned new skills. You know, I've learned how to take my own photos and participate in multimedia projects and things like that. I'm very excited and optimistic about the future of journalism. It's at the heart of it is going to be storytelling because that's what we do. It may look different. You may be reading our stories on a Kindle or on an iPad, but it's as long as we stay true to that that central focus of being good storytellers, we're going to be here.
Jesse Bonner, thank you for ending this program that looked at the best and worst jobs on an up note. Education reporter for the Ames Tribune, thank you so much. It's great to hear your passion and to read your work. Thank you.
Thanks so much for having me.
That winds up our program for today on the best and worst jobs. River to River is produced by Ben Stanton, Emily Woodbury, and Sarah Bowden. Our executive producer is Catherine Perkins. River to River is a production of Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Thanks for joining us.